Good evening, everyone. Welcome. I would like to begin by acknowledging the generous cooperation of the Asia Institute and the University of Melbourne in providing such a great venue for tonight's event. My role here is really as a co-organizer, but I feel very privileged that we have Mr. Tay Yong Ho on his first visit to Australia and only his second engagement as part of that visit to be here talking to us tonight. And we'll be leading Tay in conversation with Professor Song. And we both met Mr. Tay in Seoul just about a year and a half ago. I should also, in the interest of full disclosure, let you know that I have a personal connection with Mr. Tay going back a little bit further than that. In a previous walk of life, I worked for the UK Foreign Office in London, and I was the North Korea and South Korea analyst there. And Mr. Tay at that time was my occasional interlocutor, occasional sparring partner, and we would often take long walks in St. James's Park, just close by the Foreign Office, which actually, looking back, was a professional highlight of mine. So it was a great pleasure to see Mr. Tay then, on, as it were, on the other side of the fence, unrestrained in what he could say and what he thinks. And I think he is not just one of the most high-ranking defectors in recent years, but he is a walking authority on North Korea. And that knowledge and acumen can only come from someone who spent their time living and working in North Korea as a professional diplomat. And that, I think, gives him a pedigree that no North Korea analyst outside can hope to match. And that's why I think the insights that he brings and the honesty and clarity with which he presents that, and also the courage, the moral courage, to have taken the extremely risky decision to defect from North Korea, and the security that you saw tonight as you came in is a reflection of the fact that there are continuing risks around that. So I would also, I'm very thankful for you for taking the risk and the effort to come all the way to Australia today. Maybe just to get the conversation started, I'll ask you a general question, and then Dr. Song can take over in the next round of questions. But what does it feel like to be a defector? If you've now had 3 years since your experience of crossing the line in London, and you're now based in South Korea. You've been all over the world to tell your story. But what are the surprises? What were the expectations that were fulfilled, and what actually was most surprising to you in that intervening 3 year period looking back?
Okay, thank you very much for your wonderful presentation. If you allow me, I would like to say a few words to the audience about our, you know, past relationship of how, yes, how we spied each other. Yes. At that time, when I was in London, at that time, I was the counselor of the embassy, and I was number two. And the ambassador at that time was the current North Korean foreign minister, Lee Yong-ho. And Lee Yong-ho was actually the direct foreign policy reporter to Kim Jong-il at that time. And at that time, it was in America, it was a Bush administration's the period, and that was the just years before the North Korea's first nuclear test. So at that time, Kim Jong-il thought very deeply whether North Korea can cross over that red line or not, and if North Korea did that kind of nuclear test, then what would be the response from the free world, and would America can actually attack North Korea? Because in 1993, at that time, Clinton administration actually planned the surgical strike against North Korea in order to annihilate North Korea's nuclear facilities. So before 2006, the first nuclear test, we wanted to read the Americans and then free world mind. Then how do we read? Because if I meet Yuan in his official office, then the talk is very, it's a little bit, you know, limited in the atmosphere. So, and in North Korean foreign activity, no diplomat is allowed to meet privately with the counterpart. So we need a special permission how we can read. And I was privileged to meet my alone privately with Yuan, and we decided to meet not in the office but St. James Park, and we wanted to read whether if we cross this line, whether the free world will attack North Korea or not. Because at that time, all the embassies worldwide want to read Americans and British, what was their plan. And then at that time, after the Iraq war, Britain, the politics was involved about the cause of Iraq war. Tony Blair was in a very difficult period, and America and Britain failed to find out the mass destruction weapons, you know, the facilities and materials of all this. So after these kind of, you know, spy games, North Korea learned and decided if North Korea conduct first nuclear test, there will be no America's military surgical strike or whatever. That is the conclusion we got. So it was a really a long process of spying each other. Yuan always tried what is the real intention, when, and what is the final, you see, whether North Korea's nuclear development is just a kind of, you know, bargaining chip, or North Korea is really want to get that nuclear weapon. So that was, I think, the basic, the character of our spying, right?
I think you were better at it than I was.
Yes, and if I come to your questions, now it is my third year in South Korea. And, you know, I was a diplomat of North Korea. But in North Korea, you know, the whole country is disconnected from the world. And there is no internet. But North Korean diplomats are privileged to have access to internet. So during my profession in London, I tried very hard to learn as much as about South Korea, freedom, democracy, all these things. So I thought myself that I really knew a lot about South Korea. But now, after I arrived in South Korea, and when I was deeply involved in South Korean politics, culture, and of all these environments, I learned that my knowledge was not enough to fully understand South Korea. So I think South Korean, I think the environment of political culture is very much complicated. And as my private life is concerned, of course, you know, the life in South Korea is not easy, but I am happy with it because now I can do anything what I want to do. So now I enjoy the merit of freedom in my late 50s.
First of all, thank you so much for making the long trip from South Korea, and congratulations for making the first trip to Australia, and also making all the way down to Melbourne and meet some of my students. You're so lucky. In one of the tutorials, he made a surprise visit. The student have, who is he? Rolling eyes. So then Googling, you know, his name, realized who he is now. But thank you so much for your very special trip. Personally, I feel great privilege to have you here, and also two of your colleagues as well. My question is more about your elite education, your life back in North Korea. We all know that you're from a very privileged family, not just yourself, but also your wife is a relative of Kim Il-sung's comrade. Yeah. So you're both from very privileged family background, and going to, obviously, you're very smart and clever to go to Pyongyang University of Foreign Studies. And how the North Korean diplomat, the elite, are selected from, is it starting from a very young age? What's it like, the university system in Pyongyang?
Oh, now North Korea terms me as human scum and a traitor, yes, but actually I am a traitor to North Korean system, because I really betrayed all those benefits and privileges which I enjoyed in my life. I would like to tell the audience that North Korea is the only country in 21st century where they still keep a very strict class system. So whole population of North Korea are categorized into three classes. The first one is core class, and second one is wavering, and third one is hostile class. And I was very lucky because I was born in core class. So if you are a core class, then you have much more availability of your residence, opportunity of education, and opportunity of the job. So I was lucky, and also I worked very hard in my primary school. So when I reached the age of 12, I had examination. Not all the students, pupils of North Korea can get that kind of opportunity, but I was born in core class. So I passed the examination to enter foreign language school when I was 12 years old. And when I entered that foreign language school, all of a sudden, I received an English BBC Lingaphone course. This is a British textbook. And when we start to learn, at that time, there was no any relationship between, it was 1974, so there was no any relation between North Korea and the free world. So that's why English education was important, but how to teach English to young generation of North Korea was really a problem. So they just imported one or two British Lingaphone courses and copy it and then distribute it as a textbook. And when I opened the textbook, I was surprised to see that the pictures of that textbook was really surprising. For instance, in Britain, when British people have a breakfast, they have a lot of things, bacon, what is bacon? Ham, milk, cheese, of all these things. At that time, even though I was born in rich family in North Korea, for breakfast you have only kimchi and rice and soup, that's all. But in Britain, you have a lot of things on the tables. And when I was 12, yeah, and when I entered that school, you know, the school even showed the young students of British and American films like Mary Poppins or Sound of Music. But we were taught in primary school that America is our sworn enemy, you know. But all of a sudden, we watched these films. So, and the teachers always taught us that you are a privileged, you know, generation. So that's why the things you learn, the things you watch, the contents of the films you watch should be stay at your heart. Not, you shouldn't tell it to your former friends or even your family members, whatever. So I was very privileged to have that kind of education. And when I was 14, all of a sudden, the party ordered me to go to China to study. So I was sent to China at age of 14. Yes. So in a sense, I am really a very privileged and a very beneficial life. And as, when I became diplomat, I even was privileged to take my family members to European capitals. In North Korea, nobody can dream of going abroad with their family members because there is no even freedom of moving from one city to another. But I was privileged to take my wife and children to London, Stockholm, Copenhagen. So to North Korean standards, I'm really a traitor, you know.
I think the subversive value of Mary Poppins is never to be underestimated, is one of the key takeaways from Mr. Tay's memoir. I'm going to go straight into some of the questions because they're coming in thick and fast, and I think there's no reason to wait on that. But there's a lot of interest in the theme of reunification, which I know is something that professionally occupies a lot of your time now. And the question is, do you want reunification? In whose best interest is it? Maybe I can also ask you to talk a little bit about how the attitudes to reunification differ between the North and the South, because you have uniquely seen it from both countries, and also amongst the older people and younger people.
Oh, I think the Korean reunification would take really a long process than expected, because the current the established generation look into this process of reunification quite differently. For instance, from the southern part of the peninsula, now for young generation, more and more young generations are not interested at all in reunifying again with the North. While the old generation in 70s, they think that, oh, North Korea, the people are our brothers, so we should be reunited again in the future. But while the young generation in South Korea, oh, no, why? Or, you know, they are not interested at all of reunifying with the North. But if you look back to the North Korea, also there is a generation of the gap. The current generation, which is called the, in North Korean terms, the second generation. Now, in North Korea, Kim Jong-un is the only person in 30s in North Korean leadership. The rest of the North Korean leadership around Kim Jong-un are all in 60s, 70s, or 80s. So the supreme leader of North Korea is his third generation, but he's surrounded with the second generation of all these people. And the second generation of North Korea, and also second generation of South Korea, they regard the issue of reunification as a kind of overwhelming the others, like observe or merging or winning the other part, you see, of the Korean Peninsula. But while the younger generation in North Korea, they are different from young generation in South Korea. Young generation in South Korea, they are not interested, not all, but majority of the young generations are not interested in reunification. But the young generation in the northern part, they're different because they learned the failure of North Korean system. So that's why they are looking for something new. They are very eager to know about South Korea, and that's one of the reasons why South Korean movies and dramas are very popular in North Korea. North Korean regime tried very hard to prevent the inflow of South Korean the cultures, but there is a great demand by young generations. So that's why that demand was commercialized by the smugglers. So new films and cultural contents are going to the North Korea's young generations, and they reach it. So when I was in North Korea, I tried very hard to stop my children watching South Korean movies and dramas. I said, it is very dangerous. If you are caught by the police by carrying these, you know, the USB sticks, you see, then you would be sent to prison or whatever. So I strongly asked my sons not to watch it. But because of the this kind of IT, the technology, now, in the past 20 years, the size of this physical South Korean cultural contents getting smaller and smaller. So even 10 years ago, if you want to watch a South Korean movie, you have to buy this size of DVDs, yes. But nowadays, even it is now smaller to that of this smaller size like SD card. So for instance, the young children in North Korea, they always take that SD card, and if the teacher or police search their bodies, they either, you know, put it in their nose. So in North Korea, this card is called nose card, you know. They can very easily keep it all, I say, under the, you know, the sack. So that's why I strongly envisage that this kind of very strong demand for information and for the knowledge about South Korea can, I think, make one day that the similar things, what is going on in Hong Kong, may take place in North Korea one day. They may ask, you know, same value or same treatment like South Korea. So I think the push of future Korean reunification would come from northern part, not from the southern part. That is my predictions.
I have a sort of relevant question to that. So there are a lot of activists who advocate for the access to information is very important. So smuggling those, SD cards or USB sticks containing information about outside world, smuggling them into North Korea through the China-North Korea border, that's been advocated by many activists. But if you see from Chinese or North Korean sovereignty or their perspective, it's an illegal activity. Smuggling goods is an illegal activity. It's highly, highly dangerous for those who are doing those acts. What's your take on this approach? International human rights activists smuggling DVD versus that's against the sovereignty of the two countries.
Before I tell. Answer that question, I think I have to emphasize and note the current changes inside North Korea, especially among the popular masses. For instance, in the past 20 years, there was a widespread of capitalist market elements even inside North Korea, in spite of strong crackdown by the government. Now, the numbers of this free market or black market even passed over 440. So American satellite system can detect and the increase of fast increase of this black and free markets in North Korea. So the one thing is sure that Kim Jong-un regime cannot stop this spread of capitalist the elements inside North Korea. And also in North Korea's 70 years of history, Kim Jong-un regime has seen a mass resistance once. In November of 2009, Kim Jong-un decided to have a devaluation currency reform. But within 1 month, the whole masses of North Korea protested and did not accept this currency reform. So after 1 month of this currency devaluation reform, it turned out to be a failure. So in order to turn the responsibility from him to the other people, Kim Jong-il officially persecuted Bang Nam-gi, then who was in charge of North Korean currency system. So through this, Kim Jong-un learned that if he controls too much economically on the spread of capitalist elements in North Korea, then he would mean the final day. So that's why what is taking place that now Kim Jong-un is a little bit flexible on this kind of economic capitalist elements spreading, but he is more tough on the spread of cultural the contents from South Korea. And for how to disseminate those South Korean cultural contents in the past 10 or 20 years, North Korean young generation people just merely watched South Korean movies and dramas as it is. So I think what I always propose to North Korean human rights activists and whatever, I always tell them that now it's time to make tailor-made the contents in order to educate young generations and North Korean people. For instance, I wrote one story how my children were frustrated and furious when they learned that Kim Jong-un's brother, Kim Jong-chol, traveled to London to watch see Eric Clapton. I wrote in my book that one day I was instructed all of a sudden, I was given the password from Kim Jong-un's office to open my email. So I opened my email and they phoned me, the first password is this and that. So I happened to open that the instructions, and then I learned that somebody's coming to London to watch Eric Clapton, and I was ordered to buy 6 tickets for this delegation. And in North Korea, who can travel to London to watch Eric Clapton in a very short span of time? And I was ordered to, book the expensive, the hotels, a lot of seats of all these things. So I thought it must be the Kim Jong-chol, even though he changed his names or whatever. So I planned all of this. And then, but I accepted this as kind of granted, you know, because they are member of royal family. Royal family are privileged people. They can do anything. That was my, you know, the concept. So, but I can't even report what I'm planning even to my ambassador, because that's why it, only direct communication system was established between me and Kim Jong-un's office. The point is that I just disappeared one day from the embassy and from my family because Kim Jong-chol was arriving. So I went up to the airport, I took to the hotels, and then, you know, I didn't tell where I go. So all of a sudden I disappeared, and my boys wanted to know where I am, you know, I can't back. So I stayed together with Kim Jong-chol, but it happened to be that when Kim Jong-chol first arrived Royal Albert Hall to watch the first performance of Eric Clapton, he was detected by Japanese journalists. There were many Japanese journalists. I don't know how they got that information. They knew Kim Jong-chol was coming. We kept it as a top secret, but they were new. Cameras were already there, so it was opened. So, I'm not sure. Maybe British intelligence, maybe. So that night, the world media, BBC, you know, Sky News, they all showed Kim Jong-chol's face together with my face, you know. I was just getting him in and out.
I saw that.
You saw that, right. And after Kim Jong-chol left London, I came back to, you know, my home. And then the first question my boys asked is that, how was it possible, Daddy? So, what do you mean? You know, the performance of Eric Clapton was regarded as anti-socialist dirty music. In North Korean universities and schools, we were taught from young that these kind of, you know, musics are dirty, then we should not watch it. How? The member of the, you know, the Kim family spent so much money to watch that, travel, stay in. So as a young generation of North Korea, you see, my children cannot accept it, you know. It's what a hypocrisy, you know. They asked the normal people to lead a humble life, do not watch South Korean or British or America. They all call it anti-socialist, you know, those, you know, dirty whatever. But the member of the royal family, they do anything. So my sons cannot accept. They are very furious. So I have to justify, because I was the organizer of yes. So I see. So that is one of the reasons that I think that, you know, in South Korea as well, young generation are reluctant to old generation's instructions. Same thing in North Korea. In North Korea, young generations, even though they are very heavily controlled, they do not want to listen to their parents or whatever, because they have already seen enough, the failed system. So that's why I think the future lies on next generation, I think.
Mr. Tay, when we were back in our professional days, as you put it, spying on each other, one of the things that made that so enjoyable was your sense of humor. As I think everyone here has already found out tonight, which gets to our most popular question tonight, which comes from Philip, and it's on the theme of humor. And it goes like this. Reagan used to collect jokes from the Soviet Union to see what kind of people they were from their humor, despite harsh circumstances. Can you tell us a North Korean joke? So I'm going to put you on the spot with that. See if you can come up with a North Korean joke, and tell us a bit more broadly, what is the role of humor in North Korea for ordinary North Koreans? Do jokes play the same value that they do in other societies?
Oh, I tell about one of the joke, you know, which shows the big generation gap between the parents and young generation. Now, the old generation in North Korea, once they are retired, they live very difficult life because there is no any welfare or pension system working in North Korea. So once you retire, and you lost everything. So if you are lucky to have your children who have good jobs to look after like me, then you are lucky. But if your children do not have good jobs to look after their parents, then your rest of the life will be very miserable. So from there are a lot of, you know, this kind of quarrel inside North Korean parents. So one of the jokes is that when the parents tell their children, I mean the children in a job, they say that when they say, I'm hungry, and why don't you feed well? Because I fed you very well when you were young. Then the answer is that, oh, daddy, you fed me in a state price. Do you understand what that means? State fixed price. That means when he was young, the North Korea's socialist, the welfare system was working. So that's why at that time, the income of the parents were enough to feed their children. So that's why they do not worry to feed their children in 80s or 70s. For instance, when I was born in 1962 and until the beginning of 1990s, my family can make ends meet with the salary. But when my last salary from North Korea was in Pyongyang, when I left my department, at that time I was the Deputy Director General of European Department, and at that time my one-month salary is 2,900 Korean won. At that time, how much is 1 kilo of rice in the market? 3,400 won. So with 1 month salary, I can't even afford to buy 1 kilo of rice. So if you have that kind of income, how can you feed your parents? So the humor is that when parents say that, oh, bring me more food, I'm hungry, they say that, daddy, you raised me in state fixed price, but you asked me to feed you in black market price. Yeah, it's really a sad joke, you know, yes. And everyone understands, yes.
Well, I'll take the focus to your life in Seoul. This is something that I know Jay works on in her own research, but the question is, how are you adapting to living in Seoul? Because many defectors struggle to adapt with the change to South Korean society, which is one of the most competitive societies on earth. Even to be a South Korean can be stressful, but if you're a North Korean suddenly transposed into that society, what are the stresses and strains, and how personally have you gone around coping with that?
Oh, first of all, one of the most difficult thing is language, I think, because even though I think I'm fluent in South Korean dialect, but whenever, you know, I speak for more than 30 minutes or 10 minutes, South Korean can easily detect that I'm not a South Korean, because, you know, I have a very strong Pyongyang or accent. So that is, the language is the first difficulty. The second difficulty is, even though I am from the elite group of North Korea, but the cultural difference and actually the general IT difference is so much, so great between North and South. So for instance, if I visit bank and the bank clerk, you know, ask me a lot, give me a lot of options, and then explain all things which I can only understand 20 or 30 is the percent. And in South Korea, everyone use, for instance, KakaoTalk. If you want to transfer your money from your bank account to another, you have to put in your password and put in, how do you say in Injungso, you know, a special certificate. So you have to remember a lot of passwords to do, you know. So it is, so this kind of, you know, the cultural difference is really difficult. And another thing is that now I am number one, the assassination list by Kim Jong-un regime. So that's why I am really heavily protected in South Korea. My house is 24 hours monitored by South Korean police. So virtually, I do not have even a single second of freedom, actually, you know, of mine. Whenever I go out or whatever, I am heavily protected by South Korean security forces. And another thing is that even when I go out of my house, I have to disguise myself. You know, I have to carry a hat, sunglasses. Sometimes I put that on because why? First, you know, I'm afraid of North Korea's, you know, the spy agents. Second thing is that I'm even afraid of being found out by neighbors, because in South Korea, people are very much concerned about the price of their estate, and they do not want to their neighbors a kind of a political, high political issue or whatever. They think that these kind of things may reduce the price of their, you know, the houses. So it is very sensitive issues not to be found even by my neighbors, because when they found out that somebody may think that, oh, what if Kim Jong-un come and explode all our apartments, you know? So that's why, you know, I have to be very careful even not to be detected by the neighbors. So these kind of things, you know, I have a lot of difficulties. But on the meanwhile, you know, I'm very happy because I can do whatever I like. I can say whatever I like. I write the columns in newspapers. I, from time to time, I appear in TV shows to explain. Even, you know, I'm very open to criticize South Korean, current South Korean government's policy on North Korea, but there is not any intervention or interference by South Korean government as well. So I'm really enjoying this kind of, you know, good quality of freedom in South Korea.
One obvious question which gets back to your personal circumstances that's been asked is, what was the trigger point that motivated you to take that dramatic decision to defect?
Because actually, you know, I understood this hypocrisy of North Korean system in a very long time ago. But, you know, my job, my profession was to pretend to be loyal, you know, to the society. And my job was to do propaganda work of North Korean system. So I'm used to this kind of double life. But my sons were different because one of the great difference was the period of education. I was educated in North Korean system and in China in such kind of communist system until I first was posted in Denmark. That was 1996 when I was 32. So before the year of age of 34, I didn't realize this kind of, you know, contradictions or hypocrisy of North Korean system. But my children were different because my sons, they entered to British primary school or high school. So from young, they learned the freedom, democracy, human rights of these things. And as a children of diplomat, they have to switch every 3 or 4 years from this kind of free, you know, democratic human rights education to the most totalitarian dictatorship, the education. So every 3 or 4 years is a kind of switch from heaven to hell, from hell to heaven, all these things. So that's why they have very good ability of compare of two the systems. And I thought that their future life, once human beings know all these hypocrisies, then if they are back in North Korea, they have to pretend that, as a kind of, you know, idiots. That's, I think that kind of things would be very difficult for my sons. The triggering point was that in March of 2016, there were a collective defection of 12 North Korean waitresses from China. That was the first incident happened in North Korean history. They were all, in the past, they were all individual defection cases, not a kind of collective defection of one organization, you know, they're all defective. So that means that they planned, you know, in advance, whatever. So after this incident, Kim Jong-un was shocked. So he learned that because they watched too much South Korean movies and dramas, they were too much open to internet. So Kim Jong-un's next dilemma, that what would happen to North Korean the diplomats' children, because they are all in Western universities or schools, they are exposed to all these kind of free education, free concepts. So Kim Jong-un asked that university students of all North Korean diplomats must be back to North Korea before the end of July. You know, so my first son at that time was in Hammersmith College in London. He didn't finish his education, but my first son was ordered to be back before the end of July. So that kind of, you know, forced instructions to forcefully return all the university students of the diplomats, you know, angered me and my son. So I was very much, you know, frustrated as well, because I was very angry as a dad. I can't even, you know, let my son finish his education. I tried very hard to be loyal to the system, but in return, you know, the system even did not let me allow to finish my son's education. So this angered me very much, and my son, I think, that can be, yes.
Regarding inter-Korean relations and North Korea-US relations, 2018 yes. And this year is very different from 2017. We heard about fire and fury, and there was a very sort of violent exchange of words between North Korean and the US leaders. And President Moon, the South Korean president, is pushing for the peaceful coexistence and peace economy, and really focusing and advocating the friendly, the pro-engagement with North Korea, which is quite different from the previous two presidents under Lee Myung-bak and Park Geun-hye. We know that you've been saying to the media and to the public that North Korea will never give up nuclear yes. weapons. So to what extent the President Moon's moonshine, the so-called the moonshine policy, will work, and whether that will lead to denuclearization of North Korea?
Some people may think that I'm very negative on President Moon's North Korean policy, but that is not the true at all, because I only negative on some part of current South Korean's policy on North Korea. Before we talk about denuclearization issue, I think North and South Korea is sandwiched by big powers in this region. And in order to keep the dynasty of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Kim family choose the nuclear weapons as a kind of insurance for next, you know, few decades of their rule. While South Korea now is at the crossroad whether they would accept the nuclearized North Korea or not. And this is not the game between North Korea and America, but this is also the game between China and America and also Russia. So this is a game among big players. So denuclearization of North Korea is not really an easy game. And also, I strongly openly said that Kim Jong-un will not denuclearize, Kim family will not denuclearize North Korea anyway, because this nuclearization of North Korea took almost quite a long time. North Korea started its developing of nuclear weapons even in the later of 1950s. Right after the Korean War. So it was a long history. So North Korean history is just a history of developing nuclear weapons, you know. So they can't say no to the nuclear weapons. The one thing we have to be clear is that the South Korea's Moon administration's, Moon Jae-in's administration's the policy base. What is their the policy base of inter-Korean reconciliation process? The people in the Moon Jae-in, the government say that Kim Jong-un has made a very bold strategic decision to denuclearize of North Korea in return for economic prosperity. That's why if Trump administration together with the world give the enough return, then Kim Jong-un will denuclearize. I think that assumption is wrong. Kim Jong-un will not denuclearize. So we have to accept a kind of, you know, de facto that Kim Jong-un will not denuclearize. But on the meanwhile, the trick is then how we can cope with the nuclearized North Korea. I think that is one of the very difficult tactic which current South Korean government cope with. And I think, to me personally, I think there is no way to denuclearize North Korea in a short insight in the near future. I think only time can solve this problem. So only when young generation of North Korea stand up for change and bring the change in North Korea, then that is the way of denuclearize of North Korea. The current denuclearization negotiation or peace talk with North Korea cannot reach the destination of denuclearization.
You talk about the young generation in North Korea, but this gets to an interesting question. Of course, Kim Jong-un is part of the young generation in North Korea. And doesn't that set up a potential issue in a Confucian society like Korea, where elders are revered and respected? How easy is it for elder North Koreans in the system to accept orders from such a young man?
Oh, North Korea has been built in a concept of, you mentioned the word of Confucianism, but in North Korea, it's a kind of system of one family. So in North Korean education, we are always brainwashed that the whole North Korea is one family. That's why we should help each other. So if it is one family, then who is the father? So father is always from kin family. So when Kim Il-sung was alive, Kim Il-sung was the father of North Korean family. When Kim Jong-il is alive, then Kim Jong-il is the father of North Korea. When Kim Jong-un becomes the leader, and naturally, when he was appointed as the successor of Kim Jong-il, he naturally becomes the father of North Korean society. Then who is the mother? Mother is Workers' Party of Korea. And what are the rest? No matter how old you are, no matter what kind of brilliant history you have in North Korean society, Kim are the father, Workers' Party of Korea is mother, the rest is minors. So they have already established this kind of long tradition inside North Korea. So when Kim Jong-un in 20s was appointed as the leader of North Korea, the leaders around him who were in 80s accept this young leader in 20s as their father.
I hear from other North Korean defector that the concept of Trinity in Christianity, Christian belief, is very similar to Juche ideology.
Yes.
Because it's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and it's Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and Juche ideology.
Yes. North Korea's Juche idea, which is the philosophical base of North Korean society, is a very special idea. It is a kind of hybrid idea with Marxism, Leninism, and also Confucianism, and even Christianity. So if you look into deeply in North Korea's society and its managing a system, it is very similar from Christian churches. So for instance, in North Korea, there is a constitution, but above constitution, there is a party regulation. In North Korea, we call it 10 monolithic ideological system. There is a 10 principles. And where are the 10 principles from? This 10 principle is from the Christian 10th commandments. It is exactly the same. Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il just changed the word of God into Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-ilism. So for instance, number one, in 10th commandment, it is said that you should only believe God. The number one of 10th principle is that North Korea should be Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-ilized. You know, number three, for instance, you should not believe in any the cult except God. But if you read number three of a 10th monolithic ideological system, you have to absolutely believe only Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. If you see those sequences and all this, it is almost the same. Kim family even didn't change the orders of 10th commandment. It's what exactly the same. If you go to your handphone and compare these 10th commandments of Christianity and the 10th principle, it exactly matches. And for instance, the daily life of North Korea. You know, in 10th commandments of number 4, it says that you should have a holiday at least once, one day a week. So that means that you should go to church and try your religious belief, practice your religious belief. In North Korea, it is the same. Every Saturday in North Korea, Saturday is not a working day. So you should come to this kind of, you know, audience room, and then you are supposed to listen all those teachings of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. From 9 o'clock to 9 o'clock, we call it a general review. That means that everyone of the unit is supposed to stand up and say about your mistakes to the other audiences. How do you say? The first thing you should quote what Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il said. Exactly. You can't fabricate it. You just quote how Kim Jong-un said it. It is something like in churches, the priest always quote the Bible, right? And then you say about your mistakes. So if you look detail of North Korean society, it is like, you know, a kind of, you know, religious feudal system.
One more question on the nature of North Korean society. We've been asked, what about gender representation in the DPRK's foreign service and military? Is there a feminist movement, and how does this interact with the class system?
Oh, yes. According to the law of North Korea, there should be a kind of, you know, gender equality according to the law. But the only place where you can see this kind of gender equality is North Korea's Supreme People's Assembly. It is the parliament where they always open the number of the parliamentarians, and then they always open the quota of the female. That is the only place. But in foreign service or military, the majority is, I think, 99% are the male. So actually, gender equality is not provided in North Korean system. It is not only the matter of North Korea. If you look at the Marxist and Leninist theory and the rest of the socialist and communist the societies, no. The first communist revolution was in 1917 by Russia's Bolshevik Revolution. In their past history of 100 years, there was no even a single female state leader. Why? Because if you read Marxist-Leninist, they say a lot about gender equality. But the system is something like one-party system, one, you know, the leader of the system. It's very subversive a system. The people are supposed to obey all the instructions from the top. So it is really a top-down system of all socialist and the communist system. So if in the communist system is the only system where they can't produce any female
state
leader.
Can I just press you on that, though?
Yes.
Because one of the defining things about Kim Jong-un's style of government is his sister has come to prominence,
yes,
and also the head delegate in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs on the six-party talks,
yes,
is also female.
Yes.
Is that part of something that defines his particular style? Is he more comfortable, do you think, around the company of women?
I think that is really a good question. In the past, you know, there was not that kind of, you know, female the elements around the supreme leader. For instance, when Kim Jong-il was the leader, even though he had his sister Kim Jong-hee, but Kim Jong-hee was just a kind of showcase. He did not have that kind of exact influence. But now it's different. So my judgment is that what if Kim Jong-un accidentally or had a stroke or whatever because of his medical the issues, then someone should replace the Kim Jong-un. And that kind of replacement can only come from Kim family. And who could be the next if there is something happens to Kim Jong-un? So only sister Kim Yo-jong can be the next successor of North Korean system. That's why maybe because of that, Kim Jong-un is preparing a kind of post-Kim Jong-un era by giving more and more, I think, the power or kind of, you know, the influence to his sister, and he would like to change a kind of, you know, already established a kind of, you know, the images of the ladies, like, you know, Kim Yo-jong. After Kim Yo-jong, there is Choi Soon-hee. Now he is the first deputy foreign minister. After Kim Yo-jong, there is also Hyun Sung-woo. So that's why he would like to bring more and more female elements in order to prepare post Kim Jong-un, I think, the structure. That is my guess. No, the fact yet.
I actually had the same question. What's the secret of Choi Soon-hee's success? I mean, she's now appointed as one of the senior member of the Korean Workers' Party. She led the DPRK team in the negotiation with the U.S., but she's the one of the very few who survived. Kim Yok-cheol's gone, and Kim Yong-chol was gone, but now back. But she stayed and remained as a very powerful member of the party.
Yes. Oh, actually, Choi Soon-hee is the line of Lee Yong-ho, the current foreign minister. And Lee Yong-ho served quite a long time in North Korean-American negotiation, even in early of 1990s. So he almost served in just in one line in negotiation team, and Choi Soon-hee was the second line of it. And Choi Soon-hee was a female diplomat. So the rest, the member of this negotiation team, if in North Korean diplomatic service, after you work 2 or 3 years, you leave that team and you are posted to abroad. So you have a leave 3 or 4 years from that main line, and then after your service in foreign countries, you come and join again. So there is a frequent leave every 3 or 4 years, but Choi Soon-hee was female, so she was never posted to embassies in her career. She always stayed in the past 30 years in that line. She even didn't miss a single, you know, the meetings with Americans. So actually she is the living witness of the past, the negotiations with America.
We unfortunately just have time for one final question, but I'd like to bring the focus back to Australia. This is, after all, your first visit here. And the question is, rather facetiously, how many North Koreans know that Australia exists? But let's just turn that around. I think the fact that we have so many people here coming to hear you tonight shows that there is a great deal of interest in North Korea. What about impressions of Australia in North Korea? What do people know? What's the image of Australia that conjured up for most people?
The name Australia happens quite often in North Korean textbooks or novels because of Korean War. During the Korean War, you know, 14 foreign countries sent their troops, but majority of the troops were army. But Australia at that time sent air fleet. So it was there were a lot of Australian the fights in the sky at that time. In North Korean terms, it is called, I don't know why, but the sound of Australian the fighters for something in North Korean term, we call it seksegi, seksegi. When they hear the sound of different air flight, they think a fighter, they call it that is Australians. So in general term, North Korean people misunderstood that Australians are born good pilots.
I hope we're flying you back Qantas in that case.
So when I first arrived to Sydney, I tried to look for if there are many private airplanes, small, you know, private airplanes or private small airports. I was told that in Australia, before I came, when I was young, I thought Australia is a big country, but very little population. So if you want to travel from one village to another, you have to drive an airplane, no road or whatever. So most of the houses keep their small airports. That's why Australian pilots were very good in Korean War. I'm not sure whether it is true or not, whether you still really travel from one village to another by airplane.
I wish we could go on for another hour. I think there's plenty of material and interest there, but unfortunately we do have to call it time for this extraordinary audience with Tae Yong-ho. Thank you to you for your questions and your interest in the event. Thank you again to Jay Song and the Asia Institute. And let's make it the first of many partnerships between the two institutions in future. But most of all, please show your appreciation for Mr. Tae Yong Ho.